Have you always known that you're on a soul path? And have you wondered how to gain real insight into the steps along your own unique journey? Welcome everyone, I'm Sarah Main, and thank you for joining me on Dhammayanti, the show for your soul. I'm so glad to have you along. Dhammayanti means peace and calm. Dhammayanti sheds a light for your soul through the wisdom that shines in the universal language of Sanskrit. Dhammayanti is the show that speaks to your soul, connects with your soul, and enriches your soul. Join me now on Dhammayanti, the show for your soul, and be inspired and uplifted by the beautiful light of this profound, timeless wisdom. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Dhammayanti, the show for your soul with me, Sarah Main. It's wonderful to have you along. And today we're going to get straight into it. We have a very special guest, and our topic is the seven stages on the path to freedom and self-knowledge. That's a mouthful, the seven stages on the path to freedom and self-knowledge. And I actually wrote a chapter in my book on this, but Gilbert, my husband, it's Gilbert Main, my husband, he's our special guest. He wrote a whole book on it. So I brought the expert in today to talk about the seven stages, what it's about, how it relates to what we're doing, how we live our life, everything about the seven stages. He's the expert in my view. So welcome, Gilbert. It's lovely to have you along.
Thanks. Thanks, Sarah. It's wonderful to be here.
If I greeted him normally, I'd say, hi, honey, how are you?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Ree. It's good to be here.
Anyway, over to you. Let's talk about the seven stages. I know it's an important piece of knowledge that we were taught by our spiritual teachers to understand this journey of transformation, this soul path.
Yeah.
This wisdom from the wisdom traditions, originally in Sanskrit, explains so much, and it was knowledge we were given so long ago, and yet it just gives you a basis to understand what you're experiencing. I'm going to hand it over to you. Tell us about yourself and about the seven steps.
Okay, well, as you know, but the audience may not, I've been meditating and studying these sorts of areas of spiritual inquiry for over 40 years. And in my sort of non-spiritual life, I was a lawyer. I was then a headmaster of a primary school, which you were a teacher and an assistant and my right-hand man. And then since 2015, when I retired, we've done a number of things, including writing books, and getting a business started, and ballroom dancing. So we've had, if you don't believe in reincarnation, you just have to look at our career, because we've had several lifetimes in one already. But in that spiritual journey, we had incredible good fortune to have amazing teachers and to walk that path with wonderful people by our side, and to have the privilege of teaching others as well. And what I found was I kept returning again and again to this systematic approach of the seven steps, because we were told about it, of course, but we were told so much. We were given so much wisdom, so much knowledge, Sanskrit, Shakespeare, Plato, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita. But I just found myself going back and back and back again to the seven steps whenever people ask me, well, what would you do and how did you find it and what tips do you have? And so when I decided I wanted to see what it would be like to be a writer, I thought, well, look, that's the topic that interests me. Why don't I start with that? So I wrote a book. I think it was finished in 2009. And I self-published, and I didn't have very many expectations about it, but it did sell very well because it was a kind of a basic primer on spiritual work, on where do you begin, what happens next, what happens after that, you know, what are the things you're going to meet along the way, and how can you deal with them most effectively and most productively, and what happens at the end. So I wrote it at a time when the end was probably fair to say a little more theoretical than actual, but much of it has become more experiential in the years that have gone by. So the seven steps, what are they? They're really a very, very short passage from what's called the Yoga Vasishtha, which is a dialogue between the prince Rama, who's actually an incarnation of God, and his teacher, a sage whose name is Vasishtha. And Rama one day says to Vasishtha, what are the stages in getting towards the full state of being wise, of wisdom? And Vasishtha says, well, there are seven stages, and these are what they are. And he lays them out in Sanskrit very, very tersely. And sages following on from that, and our teacher himself, expound on those seven stages. And I decided in my very small way to join their ranks and write a book expounding on the seven stages of wisdom.
Right. That is a very, very good answer. Thank you very much.
In terms of
the overview of the seven stages and where they're coming from your point of view. Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, can you drill down a little bit more as to why someone would want to know about the seven stages? Because I know there are links to other traditions, and it can be a false step to start trying to parallel different traditions or explanations. But there are some connections that can be made to help the understanding. So do you want to talk a little bit about why someone would want to know more about the seven stages?
Yeah, sure, because it's not very common. It's always, you find in every tradition, there's always the whole idea with the wise, they want you to be happy, they want you to be free. But you can take that to the bank. And they want you to move from where you are to where you potentially could be. They want you to take a journey. The paradox is, of course, that when you get to the end of the journey, you realize you were always there to start with, but that's another whole issue. But the journey is always the thing that the wise want to lay out, and they want you to take the first step. Now, why? Because, you know, people are happy, people live their full life, they marry, they have kids, they get a job, they're born, they grow up, they mature, they decay, and then they die. And life just goes on, you know, leaving behind it some sort of legacy, et cetera, et cetera. But on a spiritual level, the journey is a different journey. The journey is from basically, I mean, to put it bluntly, bondage, and a kind of a happiness that's conditional, that a happiness that's dependent upon good things coming your way, some you can create for yourself, a lot of it is a bit of luck, and you sort of live a life that you think, well, this is what life is all about. And the wise look at that and say, no, that is not the way life is meant to be. That doesn't mean you live a life that's divorced from practical realities of family and work and living a productive life in society. No way at all. But it is a life where you're free from the dictates of a conditional life. And for example, well, to take one example, with Plato, who is the Greek philosopher, he put it in this way. He said there are prisoners who are stuck in a dark cave underground, this is all getting very miserable. They're chained, it gets worse. They're chained by the ankles and the neck. They can't move their heads, they can't move their bodies. They're sitting on the floor of this cold, rocky cave, and they're looking at the back wall, and behind them is a fire casting shadows on the back wall. And they think the shadows are real. And in the dialogue, it's Socrates talking to Glaucon. And Glaucon says, this is a strange image, and these are strange prisoners. And Socrates then says, like ourselves. In other words, this is the human condition, according to Plato and Socrates, that we live in a world of shadows. We believe the shadows are real. We confer honors on each other for the naming of shadows. And that's life. That's what we think. Anyway, a liberator comes along in the story and strikes the chains off one of the prisoners, forces him to stand up. He's not keen. This prisoner is a bit reluctant. And I'll echo Socrates, like ourselves. Yeah. And he turns him around. He sees the fire. He's blinded by the light, but he sees the objects like cutout figures that were casting the shadows. He says, oh, here's reality. And the liberator says, well, wait, you ain't seen nothing yet. And he drags him again, reluctantly, up a steep, rocky, dark tunnel. And again, a lot of stories have a similar element of struggle and work at a certain point in the journey, and then they come out into the sunshine. And again, he's blinded. It's too bright for him. His eyes aren't ready for this. So he looks at shadows and reflections and images, and slowly his eyes adjust until he sees reality. And that is one version of the journey. The prodigal son in the Bible is another version of the journey. In my book, I allegorize the 7 days of creation in the first chapter of the Bible as paralleling the 7 steps to freedom. So this is a universal story.
Mm. And it was really, thank you for that. It was in my previous show when I was talking about Plato's cave in terms of waking up from this waking sleep that Plato really is illustrating through the prisoners in the cave, this state of waking sleep where we're wandering around living life, but we're not actually awake, not really awake. And it struck me, this ascent from the up that rocky path, that steep path that he describes, that's uneven and rocky, to the opening of the cave and getting out of the cave. It suddenly I thought, oh, this is another example of really the 7 steps. There are 7 stages to that path, without getting slavishly trying to equate one tradition with another. But the overall characteristics are there, and that was how I thought, right, time to get Gilbert back in to talk about the 7 steps, because he's the go-to guy. So we're going to take a break shortly, and then because we've been talking about where we are, the fact of the 7 steps, where we are in life, the general state of what we call waking sleep, because we're not exactly walking into power poles and trees, but we are asleep to reality in terms of the wise, and our full potential as limitless, sovereign, universal beings, right, as the limitless. And so we've sort of covered that, where we are now, the fact of the 7 steps. So after the break, we are going to go into the 7 steps and name them, and Gilbert's going to talk a bit more about the characteristics of each one and zero in a bit more particularly on steps 1, 2, and 3, because that's where the rubber meets the road, and really where our focus needs to be in the first instance. So after the break, we're going to hear Gilbert talk about the 7 stages and the opening sequence of 1, 2, and 3. While standing in line to pay for lunch, I heard a young man say to the lady next to him, "It's okay, I'll pay for you." I assume they were together, but in the ensuing conversation, it became clear that they didn't know each other. The young man said, "I try to do something for someone else every day. Today you're it." He smiled. So did the lady, so did I, so did everyone who heard. This is a great example of Mahatmyam, having a great soul. This greatness of soul is infectious. It spreads. That young man's action delighted everyone there. That lady has a story to share with her friends and family. I'm now sharing it with you. Random acts of kindness are incredibly powerful. It's the power of a great soul, Mahatmyam. Join me, Sarah Main, on Damayanti, the show for your soul, where we discover this greatness together. And check out my website, damayanti.store. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back to Damayanti, the show for your soul. And today's special guest, Gilbert Main, who's with me to talk about the 7 stages or the 7 steps to freedom. Gilbert is the go-to guy for this. He's my husband. Very brilliant man, and he wrote a whole book on this whole phenomena of the 7 stages to freedom, to transformation, from the limited to the limitless. They can also be seen in practical things. If you wanted to, one example, our spiritual teacher used to describe is if you wanted to knit a cardigan. I think that was right. And he used to say if you weren't aware of the seven stages, you'd end up knitting a tea cozy instead of a cardigan. You'd never end up with what you wanted to in the first place. I think that was one of his illustrations just to bring it down to our level, I think. But anyway, yeah. Gilbert, we're going to talk about the seven stages now and the opening sequence in particular of 1, 2, and 3. So over to you.
Yeah, I thought one of the things we might just sort of cover is what is the ultimate aim? And you've got to, maybe most people might have to use their imagination here, but you imagine a world in which you experienced a singularity of consciousness, of love, of knowledge, where you looked out onto a world and you knew yourself to be intimately connected to everyone else, to everything else, and that you were able to relate through love, through wisdom, through knowledge to everything, internally and externally, or the thoughts that flow through your mind, the feelings that flow through your heart, and those that flow through the minds and hearts of everyone and everything else. And you were able to see needs, see things that needed to be done and do them easily and move on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to live in a world of consciousness, of conscious confidence, basically, to quote the title of another wonderful book by another brilliant author, to just live in that world. That is the world that the wise would like you to live in, where yes, sure, problems come and go, but the response to them is immediate, full, and effective. And there's joy, there's Sat Chit Ananda is what the Sanskrit knowledge, consciousness, and bliss is the ocean in which you swim. So that's on offer. That's practical politics. That's the reality that the wise would like us to experience. That's where we come out of the cave. So, but how do we get there? Because generally speaking, I think it'd be fair to say that most people don't live in that world. But if it's genuinely on offer, most people would say, I've got my hand up. Can I have? Yes, please. So the condition is, as it were, the world of shadows, the world of bondage. We're chained by the neck and ankles. We need to be free. In Plato's story, a liberator comes along. Well, that's easy. But the first step on the way to freedom, the way to wisdom, seven of the seven stages, is Shubhech Cha in Sanskrit. And that is a stage where it's called good impulse. And what it really means is you hear something, you encounter something, you read something, you see something, you meet someone, and they inspire you with some words or actions even, and you see a better way. You suddenly think, oh, okay. Like, for example, my brother was instrumental in me joining the School of Philosophy, which is where I got, I met my teachers and my wife. And so that was a twofer. And but he said to me, look, there's this place I'm going to. It's really good. They discuss philosophy. You'd be interested. And the question I had was, what really troubled me as a teenager was telling lies, just basically telling things that just simply weren't true. Not sort of, yes, I've done my homework to a teacher, you can pull the wool over the eyes. I got that. I understood why you'd do that. There was an advantage there. But just telling stupid lies, like I've been somewhere where I hadn't been there, or I've been there five times and I've been there only four. Just little things where the ego slips in and twists things to your advantage, or even not to your advantage, just twists things for no reason at all. And he said, yes, they talk about that. And they did. They talk about when I joined, I was delighted to hear they talked about forms of useless speech. and I could tick them all off, talking about as if you know something that you don't. Repetition for no particular reason. There's a list. It's in my book actually. But I was inspired. My brother was already at that place. He told me this was a good place to go. I liked what I heard. There was a sort of an inner nod. And eventually I did sign up. So that's Shubhech Cha. That was my example of it. You meet a teacher basically, or you meet a representative of that teacher. Something sparks within you, but you have to say yes to it, because those influences are everywhere. They're not lacking. There's an abundance of these little top tips waiting for you everywhere you turn. And it's just if you have, in the New Testament, the phrase Jesus uses a lot is those who have ears to hear, let them hear. And not everyone has ears to hear. It's just basically, there's a subset of humanity that has ears to hear. So that's Shubhechara. Then you get on with the work. Number two is Suvicharana, which is inquiry, but inquiry including effort, including doing something, actually getting off your rear end and actually doing some work. So if your teacher says to you, okay, you should stop. You should control your speech, and this is how you should do it. You should practice these exercises. You come into the present moment, learn to be still, learn to control the mind, and for 3 minutes, twice a day, say a teacher says that, which is the philosophy exercise that we all got. It's one of our first exercises in stillness, and then they're not going to do it for you. The teacher, the tutor, whoever, they can't sit down and do that exercise and you can't just turn up once a week and listen and be fully bathed in this wonderful wisdom and then wait for another week before you try it again. You've got to work at it. It's like I keep saying this. If you want to learn French, if you want to get good at tennis, it's no different. You find someone who knows what they're talking about. They tell you what to do. Then you've got to basically practice. You've got to hit forearms, serves across the net over and over again. You've got to practice your verbs and your conversation and et cetera. And then the third step is called Tanumanasa, and it means the thinning or attenuation, getting the mind gets thinner. The mind goes on a diet. It narrows down. And what that actually means is the habits, the modes of thought, the old ways of doing things, the things that the groove that you are in becomes less of a ruling thing in your life. Those habits begin to attenuate. And in my case, for example, taking that thing of useless speech, I remember one day I was just sort of getting out of bed in the morning and just sort of thinking, oh, yeah, there were just certain things I just didn't do anymore. I'd almost forgotten that I'd done them because they just weren't a factor in my life. And what the other sort of thing that you do begin to notice is good habits begin to establish themselves within you. So Tanumanasara is this kind of it sort of, in a sense, it takes care of itself, and it depends on how much work you do at level two, Suvicharana, which is inquiry and effort, for the habits of mind, the old habits of mind to attenuate, to thin out, to go on a diet, and for the better habits to begin to assert themselves. So you get regular things like meditation. We were introduced to meditation, half an hour every morning and half an hour every night on a mantra. That was our system. Other people have different ones. But so, that's not necessarily that easy to start with. You've got to find the time, you've got to do it, and then your mind is all over the place. Everyone who does meditation, there's an initial sort of buzz, but then it's not quite so buzzy, or not buzzy in the same way, or in a good way, after a while. Like I keep saying, meditation, it's only the first 30 years that are the hardest, but it's actually not like that. If you're listening to this, you should take up meditation. The benefits far outweigh the effort that you need to put in. They repay enormously. But something like meditating twice a day, that's just a good habit. It's a habit to get into. There is a certain part of this which isn't – there's a certain spontaneity, sure, but you're protected by habit because, it's like – You wouldn't miss meditation like you wouldn't miss lunch. Well, I mean, sometimes you just have to because you're busy, but basically most people will not miss a meal. They'll not go a day without eating physical food. And you and I are now in a happy position of not really being able to go a day without spiritual food because we just, would feel the lack.
Yeah.
That habit's there. And that gets established at Tanumanasana. That's the third level.
So that's stages 1, 2, and 3, which is Shubhechara, Suvicharana, and Tanumanasa. So the good impulse, the inspiration, Ashabhechar, the Suvicharana, which is the inquiry and effort. Inquiry is important, the questioning and inquiry and the effort, then putting it into practice, the application, so inspiration and application, and then the Tanumanasa, that sort of consolidation, beginning to consolidate this attenuation of the mind, this thinning of the mind. The mind becomes basically more disciplined and stronger. So that's stages 1, 2, and 3. And yes, you are correct, listeners, dear listeners, and dear viewers. We said 7 steps. So there are 4 more steps. So we're at the end of this show. And don't worry, I've actually got Gilbert booked to do the second show. So we're actually, the secret plan and our cunning plan was to cover the 7 steps over 2 shows, because there's just so much information to put in one, and to make it useful and accessible, we thought we'd do it over 2 shows. So Gilbert will be back for the second show, and he's going to be talking about stages 4 to 7 and then an overview, and then you'll get the complete picture and have some time to sort of consolidate and integrate the whole system. And it's important to get 1, 2, and 3. That's why we put a focus on it, because it's really where the rubber meets the road. So, Gilbert, thank you for this first show. I'm going to sing a little bit of Sanskrit. And if you want to know more, go to my website, damayanti.store, damayanti.store, and you'll find links to my book and to some beautiful spiritual products with Sanskrit on them. And also there'll be a link for this show to Gilbert's book, 7 Steps to Freedom. So here's a little bit of Sanskrit to end the show. It's the perfect prayer, which is the invocation to the Isha Upanishad. And the English is, that is perfect, this is perfect. From the perfect comes the perfect, and verily the perfect remains. May peace and peace and peace be everywhere. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Thanks, and we'll see you again. Thank you for spending time with me on Damayanti, the show for your soul. To find out more about Damayanti or to get my book, Conscious Confidence, Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success, or to purchase my range of beautiful spiritual jewelry, go to my website, damayanti.store. That's damayanti.store. Damayanti.store. See you next time.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.